This is Kate Millard, March 11th, 1991. Comparison of Jung and Freud's dream theory.
She is an analyst who's just completed her training at Zurich. She practices in Seattle. She's on our board and co-chair of the program committee. And it's with great pleasure I introduce Kate Millard to you.
I'd like to thank all of you for coming once again. I realized when I started to prepare this lecture how much I had taken to heart Jung's comment about the importance of learning the theory and then forgetting it. I needed to refresh myself, and what I used to do that was a paper that I had written for the Jung Institute in Zurich towards the middle of my training there, and from that paper I reprinted the things which I have outside on the table, which I hope everybody picked up. Some of the feedback we've gotten is that people would like to have some kind of printed material, so there's the bibliography there, and some outlines. There's a couple of small mistakes. Amplificate is not a word, it is in German. But all in all, I think those will be helpful. I'll try to follow those outlines as closely as I can tonight. Talking about theory is not the same as talking about how one works with dreams in analysis. So this is going to be a little bit more along the lines of a lecture. And it's also an enormous amount of material. So I tried to go along a bit quickly. What I'd like to say to begin with is that in the field of depth psychology, dreams and their meaning, their purpose, and their interpretation is really of central importance. Most of the current theories of dream interpretation are historically rooted and generally are in accord with either the Jungian or the Freudian schools, although, of course, there is earlier historical, biblical, and anthropological material which point towards an interest always within humanity towards the significance of dreams. Sigmund Freud was the first person to present a scientific method of dream interpretation, and in doing so, what he did was open the door to a psychological understanding of dreams. Carl Jung, at the same time, was investigating unconscious phenomenon. I talked a bit in my first lecture about Jung and his work with the association experiment, which was going on at the same time that Freud was beginning to work with dream material and also with what we call the Freudian slips. These theories are quite different. Jung's theories developed to a certain point. He went in the same direction as Freud, and then they went in greatly different directions, particularly in the conception of the contents of the unconscious. And I think it's very important for those of us that are interested in dreams to have some idea of the foundation of where this work began. Just about everything that I'm going to say about Freud tonight I garnered from this book, which is called The Interpretation of Dreams. I'm not a Freudian. I'm not well trained in Freudian theory. I know a little bit about Freud and dreams, and a lot I don't know about Freud. If there are any Freudians in the room, bear with me. I highly recommend this book. It's an absolute delight to read. In this book, Freud says the interpretation of dreams is the via regia, or the royal road, to a knowledge of the unconscious activities of the mind. Now, if we can imagine in 1898, that's probably when he was working on this book, it was first published in 1899, Freud was a psychiatrist, a medical doctor. He was dealing with people who were described as being neurotic, and what he was looking for were symptoms. The dream, then, for Freud, became a neurotic symptom. And he decided that this dream came from a level below consciousness, and he called that the unconscious. For Freud, the unconscious contains all the material which a person has repressed or forgotten since birth, and is therefore a region of intense suffering, a region of neurosis, and of psychosis. The dream then shows us which objects or experiences are unconsciously occupied with energy, with libido. Freud says that the dreams of normal people, bear with me with the language, a lot of this language is coming right from Freud, which I think is necessary in a way. He says that the dreams of so-called normal people are the same as the dreams of neurotic people. Both of these dreams are from repressed contents. As ego energy is used to repress these contents, the difference then between a normal person's dream and a neurotic person's dream is the ratio between the free and the repressed bound energy. When too much libidinal energy is needed to repress unwanted contents, an individual becomes neurotic. So according to Freud, we all have the potential to be neurotic. And as we become neurotic, the dream then presents a symptom. This is a quantitative difference. It's not a qualitative one. The starting point of Freud's dream theory is to distinguish between what he calls the manifest content of the dream and the latent content of the dream. This is very simple. And until he published his book in 1899, dreams were always interpreted from an understanding of the content of the dream as it was remembered. This is what Freud called the manifest content. Then, as opposed to the latent content. Now, he arrived at the latent content of a dream by noting all of the associations that a person connects to the manifest content of the dream. In other words, you have this dream that you've written down when you woke up in the morning. And then when asked or on your own, you start to list all of the things that you relate to that. The first is the dream, the manifest content. The longer part is called the latent content. So the dream, then, to Freud, acts as a sort of pictorial representation in the unconscious of the dreamer. And it wishes to be acknowledged. In order to understand the manifest content, one must first obtain the latent content through a translation of this obtuse and obscure language of the unconscious. For Freud, then, the manifest dream is a facade. And behind this facade lies the meaning which can be interpreted through a collection of latent content. His approach to the dream is an analytical one. He takes apart the manifest dream for the purpose of establishing associations which will shed light on the dream's meaning. Now, Freud analyzed thousands and thousands of dreams, and he kept very careful records. And after doing this, and always doing it in the same way, collecting this latent content, he drew certain conclusions as to where these dreams came from. He said, first of all, that one source of dreams was somatic. Now, this was nothing unusual. Up until this time, historical data concerning dreams had pretty much assumed that all dreams were somatic. Where Freud differs from his predecessors is that he said that that was not the only source of dreams. Now, somatic, what I mean is anything from indigestion to the alarm clock, an open window, sleeping on your arm the wrong way, all of those kinds of things that tend to happen while we are asleep. Freud pretty much said that the somatic sources of stimulation during sleep are common, and they're a regular occurrence in dreams. The second source of dreams, he identified what he called daily residues. I love this word, the leftovers of the day, the things that we didn't choose to remember, we didn't care to remember, or we didn't like to remember. And those, he said, are found in every dream. The third, and without a doubt the most important source that Freud came up with, was what he called infantile drive wishes. Now, these are wishes which arise from the unconscious, and they have an infantile character, because Freud says the unconscious has an infantile character. He says that the things that come up from the unconscious resemble childhood experiences, that the unconscious pictures or acts as if it were a child. The child that has a kind of unlimited egotism, he called this kind of activity polymorph perverse. I'm sure that's words that you've all heard. Which essentially means that there are no adult, if you will, boundaries such as no incest, nothing disgusting, no sex with animals. It's mostly about sex, but not always. All of these kinds of things over which we now have rules and which we may talk about here but not there, this is what Freud felt was relegated to the infantile unconscious. And then these came up in dreams, wishes in dreams. So thus far, what I've tried to explain is that Freud saw the dream simply as a symptom, a neurotic symptom that was trying to speak about something that wanted to be fixed. He distinguished a manifest content, the written down dream, and a latent content, which were all the associations of the dream. And he said that the dream originated from three places: somatic, origination, and these leftover daily life experiences, left residues, and also as a result of infantile drive wishes. With these ideas in mind, Freud proceeded then to try to understand what might be the function of the dream. And he determined that the dream had two functions. One function of the dream was, in fact, a caretaker of sleep. In other words, that the dream served the purpose of prolonging sleep rather than waking people up. He said that dreams are, in fact, the guardians of sleep and not its disturbers. To carry out this role, dreams serve the purpose of allowing our unconscious wishes originating from this repressed infantile drive to be fulfilled during sleep. He contends that all dreams, without exception, are wish fulfillments, although they may be disguised by every possible means. The wish, then, at first glance, may seem to originate from desires left over or suppressed in the preceding day. Those would be the daily residues. But upon further analysis, Freud says that these somewhat conscious wishes can be linked to infantile drive wishes, which have been held under repression and which, without fail, always come from the unconscious. So the dream lets these wishes out, and in that way, the dream is what he called a caretaker of sleep. Now we proceed to the dream work. What did Freud, how did he look at these dreams? What did he do with these dreams? The dream work, I would say, is the process by which one connects the latent content back to the manifest content of the dream. I'm going to talk about four parts of the dream work: that of condensation, distortion, displacement, and Freud's use of symbols. Now, condensation, that's simple, right? It's the reduction of a large amount of latent content into a very small amount of manifest content. The dream elements can contain maybe only an element, maybe a word or one image, and yet when the person starts to talk about it, it might go on. You could talk maybe for pages and pages. I'm sure you've all had this experience, that you can say a dream in 5 minutes, but then if you start to talk about one thing in the dream, like the wild wolf or something, then that associates to this, to that, to that, to that, to that, and pretty soon you have this whole story. This is the way that the unconscious presents these images in such a condensed form. This would be what condensation is. And you have to realize that nobody ever thought about this before. So at this time, these ideas, which I think probably seem a little obvious to us, were not at all obvious to anybody then. Then he went on to realize, after looking at all these dreams, that dreams were distorted. And Freud determined that dreams were distorted by a factor which he called the dream sensor. And this dream sensor is very important in Freudian work. It's actually pretty important generally, I think. This term is used to describe a phenomenon through which the difference between the manifest content and the latent content comes about. The way this works is that, according to Freud, is that the wish is so distasteful to the person that this sensor keeps it from being represented in the dream. The sensor is the same thing that causes the resistance to certain associations and certain interpretations. So the effect of this dream sensor can be to eliminate certain words or eliminate certain scenes or distort the content of the dream or make something that's not very important appear important and something that's very important appear not important. Basically, what's happening, Freud says, is that this sensor is supporting the conscious judgments of what is proper and what is acceptable, and is suppressing these unbridled, egotistical, unconscious wishes, which in the unconscious are seen as despicable, and in an ethical or in an aesthetic or in a social sense. So this is kind of like it works, I think, in much the same way as Freud's idea of the superego works. There's this sort of judging sensor in here that has a lot to do with how the dream presents itself. Hate and revenge and death are wishes that are very unpalatable to most of us. And so they, according to Freud, get represented in ways that are a little bit easier to take. And it takes quite a long time to get to the sort of bottom of the problem. Another thing that he describes that happens in dreams is called displacement, which is really how distortion is achieved. And it comes about also by the dream sensor. Essentially, what displacement means is that unacceptable things are replaced by less threatening things. Or unimportant details maybe take precedence over important details. In order for these dream thoughts to enter into the dream, then, they have to sort of circumvent this sensor, this dream sensor. So the images that are produced in dreams, functioning as a disguise through these mechanisms of distortion and displacement, are sometimes represented in a symbolic manner. Now, I think all of you have some orientation towards Jung, so you have to forget that for a minute, because Freud has a totally different orientation towards symbols. A symbol, essentially, is one thing that stands for another thing, we could say. Actually, that's the definition of what we call a sign, but that was how Freud viewed symbols. He viewed symbols as being concrete, unchangeable. He deciphers a symbol in a causal and in a reductive manner. The question that Freud might ask would be, what does the symbol stand for? The symbol, then, in this direction of thinking, is reduced to its most elementary and simplest form. For example, an apple, in a Freudian sense, is a symbol for the female breast. It always is so. It's fixed, and it never represents anything else. Whereas if we had elongated objects, such as knives and church steeples and whips and such things, those, of course, always represent the penis. This understanding is a semantic understanding. It's delightful to read. read the section on symbols in this book. It's really very funny. But one of the things that Freud says is that a room often, or is a symbol for the house is a symbol for the body, and the room then could be a symbol for the vagina. So then if you have a dream where somebody's going in and out of a room, Or going up and down stairs would then be sexual intercourse. This is the kind of semantic way that Freud deals with symbols. He remarks that all dreams, by the way, he does say that not all dreams are of a sexual nature, but the strongly disguised ones are primarily, although not exclusively, sexual. He finds sexual symbolism to be by far the most frequent, resulting from the phenomenon of regression in dreams, which gives rise to these infantile drive wishes which have been repressed and which are often related to sexuality. I just remembered that while we were talking about the somatic origins or sources of dreams, I don't know if anybody read Calvin and Hobbes yesterday morning in the Sunday paper, but I did. Actually, somebody called me to tell me about this somatic dream. So I cut out this cartoon. I'm not going to explain it. It's silly to explain a cartoon, but I'm going to pass it around. It's always nice how these things sort of fall in at the moment that you need them, especially when somebody calls you up and says, oh, by the way. Now, Freud worked many, many years with dreams, and he worked with dreams, with the dreams of people who he determined to be mostly neurotic people. He didn't work very much with psychotic people. And what he was trying to do was unravel the psychological structures of such pathology as hysterical phobias and obsessional ideas. And what he thought, and he wasn't the only one, Joseph Breuer was also a person who more or less originated this, was that if these pathological symptoms could be traced back to their source and unraveled, that then the symptom would disappear and the patient would be freed from it. And this, in fact, works very well. It certainly worked well with conversion hysteria, and that's one of the things, of course, that Freud was very famous for doing. And when he turned to dreams, he just naturally began to consider the dream to be another neurotic symptom, and therefore he set about to come to an understanding of dreams through a method that he called free association. He assumed that dreams were psychic phenomena, that the dreamer knew what the dream meant, but he didn't know that he knew. And the reason he didn't know was because of the mechanism of repression. So in order to arrive at the dream's meaning, it's sufficient to ask the dreamer not what the whole dream means, but to dissect the dream into parts and find out all of the associations that the dreamer might have about every one of those little parts. Freud would encourage his patients to adopt a non-reflective attitude, a non-critical attitude, and follow these involuntary thoughts as they would emerge in association to different aspects of the dream, disregarding any need to make sense at all of what was going on. This is where the couch comes in. You lie on the couch and you talk forevermore about what you associate, and then you associate to what you associate, and then you associate to what you associate to what you associate. And it takes a long, long time. I don't really mean to be making fun of this, but I do think sometimes it can get a little time-consuming. The main rule that Freud had, or that he started out with, was to accept every association, no matter how unimportant it might seem, or senseless, or inappropriate, or painful. Because as these voices come up, these critical voices that say, oh, that's inappropriate, or oh, that's, I can't talk about that, then the things that are being repressed are always the most important. The greater the degree of resistance, the further from consciousness is the content. So he used this free association technique when working with dreams. And the other technique, that of deciphering symbols, he called the assistant translation technique. You'll probably never hear that word again, or that phrase again, but you've heard it once. Freud said, and this is a quote, he said, there is no necessity to assume that any peculiar symbolizing activity of the mind operates in the dream work. but that dreams make use of any symbolizations which are already present in unconscious thinking because they fit in better with the requirements of dream construction on account of their representability and also because, as a rule, they escape censorship. In other words, it isn't the unconscious that has anything to do with this, but that there are these symbols, and these symbols always mean these things, and so they fall in to the dream because they fit there. The symbols found in dreams, he says, originate in folklore, in mythology, in legend, in linguistic idioms, proverbs, jokes. You know, he wrote a whole book about jokes. His other, I think, really wonderful book is called The Psychopathology of Everyday Life. The common element between some symbols and what they represent is pretty obvious, whereas other symbolic representations may be rather obtuse. Relatively few things altogether in Freud's work are represented by symbols. As I said, the human body, he says, is represented perhaps by a house. Parents might be represented by kings and queens or emperors or empresses or other respectable figures. Birth, Freud said, was often represented by a relationship to water. And then all of the various sexual organs and acts, of which he had quite a lot of different symbols that he felt were related to sexuality. This discussion now, it's really brief, but I've tried to go over the basic ideas that Freud presented in his book in 1899. That's what I've done. I hope I've done. Jung, of course, was very familiar with this book, and Jung's position with Freud was, he said that Freud's great achievement is to have put dream interpretation on the right track by recognizing that the dream interpretation can never be done without the dreamer. That this is very significant. I mean, Freud always worked with the dreamer. And that the words composing the dream narrative have not just one meaning, but they have many meanings, which issue from the unconscious part of the psyche. For Freud, the dream was indeed the royal road to the unconscious. And his contribution in the field of dream theory laid the foundation for, in the area of depth psychology in this century, for everything that we know today. And certainly had a very strong influence on Carl Jung. One comment that I'd like to make after having read this book fairly carefully is that one can get the impression from reading Freud that he was really more working with complexes than he was working with dreams. I talked about complexes in the introductory lecture of this group of six, the one I'm going to do again next week, and I don't want to talk about complexes tonight, but it seems that more and more as I read this stuff, I realize that Freud he really more or less ignores the dream as it appears and spends a great deal of time with these free associations. Then from all of this material, he tries to piece together these things into something that makes sense. And I think in that process, one allows a lot of room for one's complexes to appear, and one can direct this kind of free association seems to always sort of lead to a complex, which can be useful, but I'm not so sure that it's so directly related to the dreams. And I just wanted to make that comment because I think it's kind of interesting and something that we can perhaps talk about later. Now I'd like to move on to a subject nearer and dearer to my heart, which is Carl Jung and his theories. What I wish to do first is to read a quote. It's not very long. To give you an idea of the difference in the approach and in the feeling of these two great men. This is a quote from volume 10, which is called Civilization and Transition. Jung says, The dream is a little hidden door in the innermost and most secret recesses of the soul, opening into that cosmic night which was psyche long before there was any ego consciousness, and which will remain psyche no matter how far our ego consciousness extends. It remained for the rationalism of our age to explain the dream as the remnants left over from the day, as the crumbs that fall into the twilight world from the richly laden table of our consciousness. These dark depths are then nothing but an empty sack, containing no more than what falls into it from above. It would be far truer to say that our consciousness is that sack, which has nothing in it except what chances to fall into it. That sort of says it all. You know? Jung had, of course, studied with Freud. You probably all know that. He was a student of Freud's. And certainly he, like Freud, believed that dreams are fragments of involuntary psychic activity, just barely conscious enough to be remembered. Where these two men differed substantially and forever was in their concept of the unconscious, which for Freud was completely composed of repressed personal material, some of which showed up in dreams and which could be dealt with in a manner much like one would deal with any other neurotic symptom. Jung, on the other hand, maintained the existence of different levels of the unconscious. The first he called the personal unconscious, in which repressed contents such as thoughts, perceptions, values, and emotions reside. The deeper and far more pervasive collective unconscious contains archetypal material common to all humankind, and it's in this collective part, or objective part, of the psyche that the motifs in dreams are rooted. The words, when I speak of the collective unconscious, I often use the word objective psyche or autonomous psyche. And those two words are, I think, mean the same thing and is relating to this level of the collective unconscious, just in case that isn't clear. This hypothesis that this exists, this level, is based upon the assumption that all behavior and our ways of perceiving experience are already potential within the person before becoming actual, and that these potentialities are contents of the collective unconscious. The dream, then, for Jung, is not necessarily a wish fulfillment, and it's not only a reflection of the dreamer's personal experience, but rather it is also a product of the collective unconscious, containing an objectivity useful for regulating psychic balance, irregardless of the wishes of the ego. Jung defines the dream, then, the manifest dream, as a spontaneous expression of a psychic condition of a person in the moment. Jung maintained that a continuous process of unconscious in the unconscious generates dreams and fantasies all the time, although only a very small portion reaches the level of consciousness, and thus the unconscious contains more than just repressed material. It's a very creative force that we can tap into, not always at will. Very briefly, I would like to say that Jung also discussed the structure of dreams. He did this in a simple way, much in the same way that one would discuss the structure of a play, and also in the way that I learned to discuss the structure of a fairy tale. The usefulness of this is pretty much, I think, just to provide words when one is trying to talk with another one about dreams. Very quickly, he talked about the exposition of a dream, which would be the beginning part of the dream. For example, I was in a garden of a strange house with John. In the exposition, what we have are the the protagonist, the people that are involved in the dream, and the scene of action. In the second phase of the dream, Jung called, which he called the development, the dream could continue. John started to speak to me when a large dog ran across the tennis court, and I thought it was going to bite our daughter. Now, in this second part of the dream, the development, there's a tension that arises. There becomes a protagonist and an antagonist, and the situation becomes more complicated. And then in the third part of the dream, which Jung called the peripeteia, or the culmination, it might sound like this. But John bent down and began to pacify the dog, which became friendly and started to wag its tail. And the fourth part of a dream, which may or may not be present, Jung called the lysis, or the solution, which could sound like this. Then the dog followed us, playing with our daughter, and we walked out into a field and I woke up. And that's pretty simple. Much more important, I think, than the structure of the dream would be the function of dreams, which is basically encompasses Jung's theory of compensation. This is very central to Jungian dream theory, and in order to understand Jung's theory of compensation, we have to assume, first of all, that the psyche, the whole psyche, conscious and unconscious, is a self-regulating system which strives to maintain an equilibrium. This is, once again, one of these foundations of Jungian thought. There is an essay, perhaps in Volume 8, it's entitled Psychic Energy, which goes into much greater detail about this theory of energy. For the moment, we will accept this theory, that the psyche is a self-regulating system and that equilibrium is more or less the goal. So any process which goes too far immediately and inevitably calls for some kind of compensation. The relationship, then, between the conscious and the unconscious is compensatory. The compensatory content in the unconscious, according to Jung, is not necessarily wish fulfillment, but is an actual fact, which becomes still more actual the more we repress it. Now, that's totally different than what Freud says. I don't know if that's very clear, but what he says is that the compensatory content in the unconscious is not merely wish fulfillment, but it is an actual fact. And the more we repress it, the more actual it becomes. What he's saying is that the unconscious psyche is a reality, that there are levels of reality that we do not know from our ego and that are available to us only in certain ways, one of which is dreams, but that they are facts, that they exist, and that if we are able to develop a relationship with the unconscious parts of our psyche, then we have the possibility of a wider and a widening and broadening of the personality, which is why dreams became so intrinsically interesting to Jung, because there are other accesses, but dreams are the most direct access that we have to unconscious material. He says, every dream is an organ of information and control. Dreams are our most effective aid in building up the personality. There are three ways in which compensation might occur. If the conscious attitude to the life situation is largely one-sided, then the dream takes the opposite side through. If the conscious life situation is near the middle, the dream may give variations on that theme. And if the conscious attitude is adequate, the dream could coincide with and emphasize this tendency. Thus, the proper dream interpretation requires the questioning of the patient or of the client to find out what the conscious situation is. If a person is well adapted, dreams simply add additional material. If a person is not well adapted, the compensating unconscious material could seem to point a way towards further development. And this function, Jung said that the dream would take on a prospective character, and he called this a prospective function. This function is an anticipation in the unconscious of future conscious achievements. This, however, does not mean that the dream is prophetic. And one of the things that I think happens often and is unfortunate is that one tends to give too much credence to the unconscious and more or less blindly follow what the person thinks the unconscious is trying to say. And this is not what this prospective function means. Jung points out very specifically that the unconscious is not a psychopomp. The unconscious does not give us ever answers. A prospective interpretation may be appropriate when a dream appears to be more than compensatory, when a dream looks kind of like a preliminary plan, perhaps, or something that's sketched out. Jung says that although it's very possible that some dreams seem to be prophetic, that they are no more prophetic than a weather forecast. This is a great example. I just love it. If you just think about a weather forecast, or if you think about a dream, what you have is an anticipatory combination of probabilities, which, if they would coincide with the actual behavior of things, a certain thing might happen, but they might not. And I really feel that's very important to differentiate. I have seen people very concretely try to act out dreams in with things like perhaps with money and amounts of money and buying this or buying that, and it's really very problematic. So this prospective function certainly is there, and it simply is not prophetic. But if you think about the weather forecast, especially up here, because you just can never be quite sure, I think that's pretty much what that means. If the conscious adaptation of a person exceeds the person's capacity, we often use the word inflated, or that a person has an inflation to describe this. The dream then will take on a reductive character in order to negatively compensate. This reductive material consists mainly of Freud's repressed infantile sexual wishes, infantile claims to power, which is Adler's basic theory, and archaic elements of thought, feeling, and instinct, which is Jung's contribution. Jung believed that the reductive interpretation could help the dreamer to become more conscious of exaggerated attitudes when his inner development, for example, if his inner development is not kept up with his outer development and achievements, and also that negative compensation sometimes is necessary to keep the dreamer connected to his more childlike parts, or natural, more natural and instinctual side. The fourth function I'd like to talk about is that of finality, which differs directly from Freud's concept of causality. These are opposed ideas. The causal viewpoint looks backwards and asks the question, what caused this dream? I think I caused that. And finds usually some kind of a sexual wish being fulfilled. The final viewpoint looks forward and asks, to what purpose did this dream occur? Those are two very different things. What caused the dream? To what purpose did the dream occur to me today? That question, the to what purpose question, leads then to a thinking of how, in what way might that dream be compensatory, in what manner. The importance of this final approach over the causal approach is that the final approach allows one to further develop the personality. New ideas have a possibility of coming in. Now, Freud pretty much looked at dreams in a purely from a purely objective level, and Jung looks at dreams from both an objective and a subjective level. That are passed on in theory, in dream theory. Obviously, I don't buy these too much, but I'll tell you they are. Generally, the rules of thumb are that if there is a figure in a dream that in relationship to the dreamer is very remote or an unknown person or an imaginary or historical figure or a person that has very little significance to the dreamer, then generally the dreamer would want to see that figure as in a subjective way. Perhaps I should say what I mean by subjective and objective. When we look at a dream in a subjective way, we consider that all of the elements in the dream are a part of the psyche of the person. So if there is, for example, let's say a woman has a dream of a dark man she's never seen before that's chasing her through a room carrying a knife. Now, that person is an unknown figure for her, so it would be more likely that that figure represents an intrapsychic. Intrapsychic means within the psyche of the person, or a subjective figure to this woman. And probably that figure represents a subjective part of her psyche that's very unconscious, that she's not aware of, and that wants something. I can at least guess that. We don't know what it wants. I mean, maybe it wants to kill her, but maybe it doesn't. Maybe it wants to steal her watch off her wrist, or who knows. But anyway, that would be what I mean by subjective, whereas objectively looking at the dream would be to determine that the people, places, or events in the dream have to do with real people in the outer world. Like if I were to have a dream of my my aunt, for example, then that's someone I know very well. So perhaps that dream, and I would think, yes, perhaps that is about my aunt. Or it could be about the qualities of my aunt, which I hold within my psyche that might need some kind of attention. So this is objective and subjective. My personal feeling about this is that all dreams can be looked at subjectively. I think not all dreams can be viewed objectively. And I think, again, this part of Jung's theory is, it's helpful to know. But when I hear someone say, oh, well, I knew that person because he was my neighbor next door, and so that's about him, I kind of cringe, because we don't know. We just really don't know. So to reduce these dream elements to this or that would not be a very Jungian approach to them. But to say they can be both this and that would be much more, I think, useful. Anyway, those are basic approaches to the dream, objective and subjective. Now, as Freud worked with this free association technique, Jung worked with his basic method for interpreting dreams he called taking up the context. Essentially, what this process entails is determining all of the shades of meaning which each feature of the dream has for the dreamer. Now, the way that Jung gathered this information he called amplification. Amplifications can come from at least three places: personal associations of the dreamer, information from the dreamer's environment, and possibly archetypal parallels. If one looks at the dream as an unknown language, then the translation can be made through amplifying each image. And most of this information comes from the dreamer's associations. Jung started out using Freud's method of free association, and he stopped. And the reason that he stopped doing that extensively was because he found that this method led to an identification of the dreamer's complexes, which were not always connected to the specific image in the dream. He rather used what he called then direct association to amplify the dream. To stay with the image, I think, I probably say that more than anything in my practice. Let's go back to the image, but let's go back and see what is in the dream. Now, was that in the dream? But what does the dream say? That this is more or less the direction that a Jungian would take with the dream before the person has wandered off into something that, not that that thing is unimportant, but that it isn't related to the dream. For example, if a person dreams about a friendly puppy, then what I want to know about that puppy is what that puppy means to that person. And sometimes it's very difficult for someone to say what that means to me. Get right to the point, yes? Well, free association is not guided, if you will, by this puppy image being the central thing that you talk about. One might be said, well, what comes to your mind? Well, it comes to my mind that when I was four, my neighbor had a puppy, and let's see, that neighbor lived next door to another person, and their house burned down. That was really frightening for me. And do you see what I mean? So the free association associates something to something to something, but not around the same thing. So it's a long journey, and it can go pretty far away from the symbol or the dream thing. So there are these personal associations around the dream that are gathered. Then there is also information that needs to be gathered from the individual's environment. And this information is available to the dreamer and also to the interpreter. Such things as what happened in the day, what happened in the previous session, if this is an analytical session, or earlier dreams or historical events or local customs, or all of this is also a part of gathering this amplification. And then finally, many dreams, although not all dreams, contain archetypal content, which may also be amplified in the course of the interpretation of a dream. Archetypal parallels are needed and can be found in mythology, folklore, alchemy, all branches of the human sciences. The contributing of these parallels often comes from the dream interpreter. These are very stilted words I'm using. Because that's knowledge is accumulated over many years of study. As these parallels come from material which is contained in the collective unconscious, this is material and elements that are available to all people. They are relevant to the specific dream of any one person, but in each time a different way. I think I'm going to take the time just to give one small example from Jung of a little piece of an archetypal dream, because I often think that maybe that's a bit confusing for people. This is in volume 8 in Jung's essay called On the Nature of Dreams, paragraph 555. He's carrying on a fairly lengthy discussion about the big dreams and meaningful dreams as opposed to smaller dreams, and how sometimes big dreams come from these deeper levels of the unconscious. He says the big and meaningful dreams come from this deeper level. They reveal their significance, quite apart from the subjective impression they make, by their plastic form, which often has a poetic force and a beauty. As I read this, try to remember, I'm sure you've all had one of these dreams. Such dreams occur mostly during critical phases of life, in early youth, puberty, at the onset of middle age, and within sight of death. Their interpretations often involve considerable difficulties because the material which the dreamer is able to contribute is very meager. They don't connect directly to something that happened yesterday. For these archetypal products are no longer concerned with personal experiences, but with the general ideas whose chief significance lies in their intrinsic meaning. For example, a young man dreamed of a great snake that guarded a golden bowl in an underground vault. Now, to be sure, he had once seen a huge snake in a zoo, but otherwise he could make no real associations to this dream. Judging by this context, unsatisfactory context in the dream, which actually produced a very powerful effect, it was impossible for him to explain why he had so much emotionality around this little tiny dream of this big snake in this cave. In such a case, we have to go immediately back to mythology, Jung says, where the combination of snake or dragon with treasure and cave represents an ordeal in the life of the hero. Then it becomes clear that we are dealing with a collective emotion, a typical situation full of affect, which is not primarily a personal experience, but becomes one secondarily to this person. This is an experience which everyone has access to, and many, many people for millions of years have experienced. And at this moment, in this little tiny dream, it comes to this person. And it's very, very powerful. And no doubt, he will probably remember that dream for the rest of his life. I won't read more, but there is more. What I mean by that is simply the kind of family you came from, what sort of religious affiliation you might have had, where you live, what sort of neighborhood, what kind of school you went to or didn't go to, or is that sort of general information? Now, what I've just talked about are the ways in which the dream is amplified through personal associations, through information from the environment, and through archetypal parallels. There's one other thing that we mustn't leave out, and those are the dreamer's, what are they? Are the dreamer's conscious situation at the moment. And what, along with Jung maintains that it is practically impossible to interpret a person's dream without knowing and being acquainted with the dreamer. The dreamer's conscious situation includes any particularly striking happenings in the previous day or any illnesses, great life problems, family situations, religious, philosophical, and moral convictions. These things are slightly more personal than the environmental part. They are somewhat connected. What I'm talking about now are things that are particularly problematic to the individual. In his conscious situation, often constellates in the dream, and activates something in the unconscious, which then offers a comment, and that's where the dream comes from. Sometimes, for example, I may ask somebody, well, especially if I'm puzzled about a dream, is what happened yesterday? Did something unusual happen yesterday? And it's surprising how many times something unusual did. Something that immediately connects. I mean, it has meaning. That's what I mean when I say it connects. It has meaning for that person. I just want to say at the end here just a few comments about symbolism so that we can balance what I said about Freud, because Jung's, it's very different. He totally disagrees with Freud. Jung, rather, describes the symbol as acting like a metaphor, pointing to something beyond itself with many meanings. When Jung examines a symbol, he looks for elaboration through amplification, aiming towards specificness. This is exactly the opposite way that Freud, who reduces the symbol to its most elementary form. In other words, all long things are penises, whereas with a Jungian approach, there might be a knife, and that knife could represent a penis, could also represent a way of separating something that needs to be separated in the consciousness of the person so as to make it more manageable, perhaps, or to make it more clear. Jung's approach to finality differs from the Freudian causal approach in that Jung sees many equivalent, Freud sees many equivalent symbols meaning the same thing, whereas Jung's viewpoint would not necessarily contradict this, but would ask this question. He would take this a step further and say, why this particular symbol and not another one is in this dream? Why this one? I mean, this one has something personal about it. A different symbol might have the same symbolic meaning, but different associative material, thus endowing the symbol with its unique meaning, which is actually what makes a symbol, in that it has an unlimited number of meanings. Although Jung contends that relatively fixed symbols do exist in theory, that in practice it is always better to assume that dream symbols are what he called them true symbols, as expressions of a content not yet consciously recognized or conceptually formulated. The symbol holds within it a quality of the unknown. For example, the phallus for Freud is a penis. But as a true symbol, in Jungian terminology, this phallus can represent creative energy. It can represent fertility. Equivalents in mythology are the bull, the ass, a pomegranate, the yoni, lightning, a horse's hoof, and the list goes on. So what underlies all of these is an archetypal, phallic archetypal image whose nearest psychological equivalent is that of a very primitive mana symbol. Something that connects people with their God. In working in analytical practice with dreams, I think that the symbol should first be considered in relation to the conscious situation, that is, as an unknown symbol, and what this symbol might mean to the dreamer. One of the great faults of many dream interpreters, and I think this is because their ego gets in the way, is rather to immediately take a symbol, relate it to an archetype, and then begin some sort of long and exhaustive and theoretical interpretation, which is probably just about the last thing that your client wants to hear about that symbol. which I think is partly what brought Jung to say and to recommend that the interpreter learn all that he can about symbols, or all that she can about symbols, and then to forget it when confronted with a dream, so that the interpretation will be based upon the dream context, which is every time unique and not upon a preconceived idea. You've been very patient. Thank you. I know it was quite long. I'm finished. I would like to take a break now, and then I thought afterwards, if you want to read over, there's three dreams I put out there. Maybe we won't have time to talk about all of them, but I'll try to step you through one, and then maybe we can discuss the other a little bit from both viewpoints. Thank you very much. Now, is it on now? Can you hear me now? I said the comments that we've gotten from these little evaluation forms have been very helpful, and one of the things people wanted was printout material, so I tried to do that tonight. I also have some things next week when I... having slight connection problems. Now we're more... Are we more connected now? Are we connected? Connected? Everyone here? One thing that occurred to me this afternoon was that as a kind of follow-up to this talk, which is very theoretical, as I promised, perhaps in another series it might be then to talk more about how does one work with these theories or around these theories, or what or practical application of dream theory, something like that. If that's of interest, I would like to hear about that as something. for next year. Did everyone get these three dreams here? Copies of these dreams? What I was thinking that I'd like to do is kind of run through the... I think I'll kind of go through the first dream, sort of how I looked at it from a Jungian and from a Freudian perspective, just to kind of get us into the feel of how that works. And then we can talk about the second one, maybe the third one a little bit. The one thing that is important to realize is that what I've just said is that one can't really work with dreams without the person present, without the associations and amplifications of the person who had the dream. And this is true. However, the only way that we can all talk about a dream is if we choose one, and I will give you a certain amount of information, and actually not very much. So when we do this in a group, or when we learned to work with dreams at the Jung Institute in seminars, we always did what's called, it's called an objective interpretation. We used the information that we have. These dreams are dreams that of a man who, let's see, 5 years ago, he was 33 years old when I worked with him in my internship in the Midwest. He was divorced. He was a native of the American Midwest. He was the youngest of seven children, born to parents who were 45 and 50 years old at the time of his birth. He was raised as this special child, as he described himself. And from the start, he stated that he experienced his early life as one of isolation from the much older family members, and that those members rarely spoke to each other. This is scant information, I know. I think there was a gap of 7 or 8 years between him and his older siblings. He was first diagnosed as schizoaffective schizophrenic in 1978. He had a psychotic break during his final year of graduate school in the university where he was studying, and up until that time he had actually been doing very well. So let's see, that would have been 78, 85. It had been 7 or 8 years since he had dropped out of graduate school, and he was an outpatient at an intensive treatment center where I was working. The first dream that I want to talk about is the one called the penis dream. There's a whole discussion tonight of penises. Anyway, it's easy if you talk about Freud to talk about penises. The dream is that, written in the first person, these were given to me by the client. He says, I dreamed that my two 14-year-old school friends, Terry and Richard, and my 20-year-old sister were together in her bedroom. We were wearing only underwear. First Terry and then Richard took down their underwear and showed us their hardened penises. Then, to my surprise, my sister took down her underwear and revealed a hardened penis. I hesitated from reluctance, and when I pulled down my underwear, I had no penis, no balls, and no pubic hair. Now, this is a dream that he had when he was 13. He was 13 years old when he had this dream, and he'd always remembered the dream. Well, I think we could probably pretty surely say that in the dream there is some problem with masculinity. That this client, at the age of adolescence, was not consciously identified with and well grounded in his masculinity seems to be apparent in the dream, because he has no penis and his sister has one. If we look at this subjectively, then the sister in the dream could represent the feminine part of the psyche of the client. The unconscious anima, to use a Jungian term. Then we could say that Jerry's masculinity has been trapped in the feminine, or trapped in the unconscious, or trapped in the anima, as as the sister, held by the sister in this dream. Now, if we look at the penis from a strictly symbolic point of view, we could say that the male creativity, the libido, the energy, the psychic energy, the whole driving force of man's volition is represented by the penis. It is for this reason that in the world of the primitive people in archaic civilizations, the primitives worshipped everywhere as a kind of monosymbol. The penis penetrates in order to achieve and to enrich, and often in dreams represents the self, where there is an under-evaluation of sexuality. That Jerry's sister has a penis, and he has none, points to a psychic situation present at puberty in which the boy is lacking the male component necessary to carry him along on the road to sexual and to psychic maturity. The masculine element in his psyche has not been developed in him, but rather has been taken over or retained by the feminine. The world of the mothers have denied him his male identity, greatly inhibiting his psychological growth into manhood. Now, that's a possible, rather wordy Jungian interpretation of a dream without any information from the dreamer. Now let's just look for a second and imagine what Freud might say about this dream. From Freud's point of view, I think it's pretty clearly could be said that this dream could be interpreted as alluding to what Freud called castration anxiety. Now, Freud contends, and this is one of Freud's basic theories, that up until puberty, the male child loves his mother and identifies with his father, but as his sexual urge increases, the boy begins to feel threatened by the father. Specifically, the boy fears that his father will remove his threatening and offending sexual organ. This fear causes what Freud called castration anxiety. The boy realizes this fear when he sees the body of the female and that it lacks the penis, that is, the girl appears to be castrated. Because of this fear, the boy represses his incestuous desire for the mother, thus hoping not to offend the father. This repression, along with many other factors, results in the disappearance of what Freud called the Oedipus complex. As he renounces the mother, he may either identify more strongly with the lost object, his mother, or intensify his identification with the father. The direction of this identification is determined by the relative strength of the masculine and feminine components within him. So Freud might deal with this dream as a statement about the castration anxiety in the unconscious of the dreamer. Because of the presence of this anxiety, the dreamer may be unconsciously wishing that he had no penis, thus eliminating the fear of being castrated. In the dream, this wish is fulfilled as the dreamer finds himself freed from the threatening and protruding organ, which has instead become a part of his sister's body. Rather than intensifying his identification with his father, the dream figure seems to have fulfilled a wish to be more identified with his feminine components. Now, that's a very short, and I don't know exactly how good, but at least I think you can see from my two little examples there how this dream might be looked at in completely different ways. Now, what I thought we might do next is leave that dream and go to the second dream, and then I thought perhaps you would all like to contribute something to this discussion. I've been talking up here for quite a long time. I'll read the dream. I am at Lake Minatare, where my father had a trailer, and we used to spend much of our summer time. In the dream, I was swinging on a rope hung on a tree near the bank of the water in our cove of the lake. As I was swinging on the rope toward the bank, I saw the shallow water full of white and green snakes. I was now swinging back over the ground, and I saw it was utterly covered with these awful poisonous snakes. I knew I couldn't step off the rope and land on the land without stepping on or being bitten by these poisonous snakes. My foot almost reached the ground when I woke up. This was a reoccurring dream which Jerry remembered having had repeatedly around the age of 16. He said that at that time he first experienced an inability to manage a stressful situation and resorted to drugs and alcohol while he was in high school. That's all the information I have about the dream. Anybody have any comments about the dream? Yes?
That he's suspended outside of either solid ground.
The land is much more dangerous. The snakes on the land are poison. Let's think of the earth, think of the land and the water as being symbolic in the Jungian sense. Which comes first? Water usually is the sort of primordial sea. That would be perhaps more or less the unconscious, and then out of the water rises the land. And then we could maybe see something there of the more or less archetypal feminine and masculine here in these two areas, perhaps. Yes?
How old was he when he got the dream?
He was 16. Well, it could be. Mm-hmm. Could be, yeah? Go for it.
Some sort of fear of women.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let's hear it. That's all you want to know. What would Freud say? Infantile tribe wishes, you know. You have children. I was going to say you have children, the dreaming children. David? He had his first psychotic break when he was in graduate school, so he must have been about 22.
I guess my first reaction to this being going back is that this seems to be a dream that was giving indications of really that this psychotic process that he's not quite, he isn't quite aware of. This image of both the unconscious and the conscious, the reality in general, is this poisonous kale, the energy that anywhere in the steps is going to be captured.
And one aspect of it is in a way killing, and that being on the land could indicate the moving into more into life. So as he grows up or goes out, it seems to be more threatening.
So the snakes on land,
they're poisonous. The snakes in the water are not poisonous. The snakes on the land are poisonous. And they're about to bite his heel. It seems to me that the land is consciousness, yeah, and the water is unconsciousness, and that consciousness is poison, yeah. Larry?
I was just thinking about his background. His position in the family, and maybe it wasn't wanted.
Wasn't wanted, perhaps. Yeah, one could imagine that, yeah.
So that as he started seeing his own sexuality, he saw what the consequences of that were.
Possibly, yeah, that's true. White shirt? Good point, yeah. We could symbolically imagine perhaps that this tree is the tree of life. And yes? I suspect that the indication for the water snakes is that if he goes in that direction, he doesn't come out. In other words, he becomes psychotic. That would be my hit on that dream, having knowing the background as I do. Is that what you're saying? Well, yeah, I would tend to. Well, let's talk about this swinging motif here for a minute. There are two things happening here that I think are pretty important to this dream. But one of them is if he swings over here to the side of the earth, the life side, where the poisonous snakes are, he's worried that his foot's going to get bitten. Does that bring anything to mind? Achilles, yeah, good. Exactly. So what is that story? Does anyone remember that story? What happened to Achilles?
He got killed by an arrow.
That's right. And why? That's right. And why? His mother dipped him in the river Styx and held onto him by his heel. And so the only part of his body that was vulnerable was his heel, and that's how he lost his life. So it seems that this fellow has a heel problem as well. Yes?
What about the
swinging? Yeah, there are no boundaries. Yes. The division between the conscious and the unconscious is very porous. The porosity is the holes are large and lots slips back and forth. Yeah. In and out.
Carl?
I this is off the spin in a second.
Yeah, it's okay.
But I think you mentioned he's in school.
Yes.
And I think the green snakes, snakes can be knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Green can be emotions. If you think that that these snakes are dangerous, and these principles, and this is the point where it turns to love, and that it's again about knowledge that collapses and ravages you,
mm-hmm.
these snakes can be in part of that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
I was reminded of the little prince, but
that's right. That's right. Got you. Yeah, please.
I keep thinking, I don't know how this comes about, I keep thinking that shamans, there's some shamans,
mm-hmm. Yeah, this is
and
it.
And that if, mm-hmm. he, and so I'll try and connect that with it, if he somehow is able to allow himself experience the life and up from the present, then what would that lead him to? Would it lead him to more connection with his own master?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's a very good point, Clarice, that the often being bit by the serpent signals a movement into a transformation, and that transformation can't come about until that happens. And for this guy, it's close, but it's not. It's definitely not happening. Yeah. And the transformation then would be moving on into life. I suppose something like that. Mm-hmm. Serpents ever present. Well, one of the mythological, another mythological motif that came to my mind with this swinging was the in Greek mythology, the being caught between the Skyla and the Charybdis. Or we could say between a rock and a hard spot, but that's kind of where he is, and what that means psychologically is being virtually paralyzed by ambivalence, and that's one of the primary symptoms of schizophrenia. Yes.
And it's also very powerful when you keep pulling on the rope. He's suspending himself above that. Doesn't say he's stepping off the ground just as his foot.
That's right.
Just in the process of swinging, rather than actually
stepping to the ground. That's right. Does anyone think he steps? Does he? If we were to dream this dream on for a moment here, what would be one way of a resolution in the dream, Paul? Did everybody hear that? Yeah, so one thing that might happen would be that he could climb up the rope and then he would be up in the tree and he would be watching. Yeah, that would be. Yeah, he would Hanging man, yeah. He hangs upside down. I don't know what Freud would say, but what would Freud say? Let's imagine. What would he say about this? I think maybe we've already sort of expressed that with the set fear of sexuality and this and that. Okay. Well, Well, for sure, I think the dream has to do with the father and with the whole Oedipal situation, yes, and the castration complex that we talked about before. I think Freud would probably look at it that way. One thing I think I'd like to point out, just to maybe to clear this up a little bit, not that I have the answer to anything, but I think more or less symbolically, when we think about this water, we really do think of the what Jung called the prima materia, or the in the very beginning, there was this water, and all life proceeds to come out of this water, the water being this uncreated source, and very emblematic of the Great Mother, as we speak of the Great Mother. And when we speak of the Great Mother and the water and the depths, we usually are talking about the area of the unconscious. As opposed to, we also talk about the earth as being the feminine, but in this dream, the earth is something that has risen up out of the water, and I think that he's swinging above, when he's over the earth, if he could bear to be bitten, and he could perhaps move into a more healthy situation, and the other side is not as threatening. And I think that probably says for this psyche that the lure towards a psychosis is pretty strong. That sort of slipping back into the beginnings and back into the... And that's all wrapped around a major issue with sexuality, which we could say a lot of different things about.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle. And the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.